You have given me a wonderful beginning, a segue to what I'm about to say. And I'm very, very happy to be here. I love this room. As you see, it's a pre-totalitarian room, an 18th century drawing room, where I have actually got, I think this is the seventh time that I've spoken here, and I hope it won't be the last. I'm also happy to see that we have not lost our totalitarian habits. The members of the participants of the Congress were delivered here by bus about three quarters of an hour earlier, and yet we all took our seats and sat here very obediently waiting for the conference to begin, just as we would have done in 1948. So it makes me feel very much at home. So let us all get in the mood. You know that at a conference devoted to nationalism, there'll be a lot of rousing music. As a matter of fact, at a conference devoted to totalitarianism, there'll also be a lot of rousing music. So let's get roused together. May we have the first? Not quite us. I have to add you. As you'll see, this first example fits beautifully with what was said in preparation. So as soon as you're ready. Well, I'll tell you what I'm about to show you. But I won't tell you enough so that the surprise, if in case you don't know it already, will be spoiled. You know that in 1943, Arturo Toscanini gave a performance with the NBC Symphony and the tenor Jan Peerce of Verdi's Hymn of Nations, which Verdi had written for a London exposition in 1862. When Italy had just achieved its first degree of unity and become a kingdom. So he was asked on behalf of Italy to contribute a piece of music, which he did in a composition that mixed three national hymns. And we're going to hear a performance of the last 5 minutes of this Hymn of Nations by Verdi, conducted by Arturo Toscanini. Are we ready? He's been sitting for 45 minutes, so you can sit for another 30 seconds. But at the end of my talk, if I'm going late, remember that we started late.
What is it? What is it?
Here, of course, the cartoon Peanuts by Charles Schulz? Good. Many of you are not, some who I know are not American. So I can tell you this. There was once a Peanuts cartoon where Lucy comes upon her brother Linus. He's playing with one of her toys. And she takes away from him and says, "Hey, that's mine. Here, you can have fun with this." And she gives him a little rubber band. So he's sitting there with the rubber band. He stretches it like this, and he stretches it like that, and he stretches it all around through his body, and he's having a ball. He's really having, he's delighted playing with the rubber band. So Lucy comes back to him and says, "Here, give me that." Shakes away the rubber band and says, "I didn't mean have that much fun." And that's the way it was with the Soviet nationalities policy. Each of the individual nationalities of the outlying non-Russian populations of the USSR was encouraged to express its national culture up to a point. But if you had too much fun, then you would be punished. The thing is, you never knew where that point was. And that changing point, I think, is going to be a large part of what I'll be talking about here in the next 45 minutes, and I'm sure a lot of everybody will have to say. And now, Toscanini.
Oh.
everybody. It wasn't very amazing. He was able to quote the Internationale 10 years before it was even written. Not to mention the Star Spangled Banner at the end. Well, obviously, at a certain point, it stopped being Verdi, and it started being Toscanini. You know, films or videos of great conductors always seems to be a lovely metaphor for totalitarianism, because you're hearing a performance, but the one you're always looking at is the one who isn't making any sound, you know, but just giving the orders. And that's what we see here. And the reason why we have two extra anthems at the end is because this movie from which this clip was taken was issued in 1944 by the United States Office of War and Information, which was our propaganda organization, as wartime propaganda. And Toscanini was induced to making this film, and he did it without a fee as his contribution to the war effort. Because Italy, his country from which he was exiled at the time, that's why he was in New York conducting the NBC Symphony, Italy had just changed sides because Mussolini had been deposed. And for that reason, he was celebrating it. Just as Verdi, when he wrote the piece, was celebrating the unification. Then it was just the Piedmont-Sardinia unification of the north of Italy that Verdi was celebrating, not with the Italian national anthem, which was a piece called Marcia Reale, the Royal March, which remained the national anthem of the Kingdom of Italy until 1946. And so it was the national anthem at the time of Mussolini. So Toscanini would never have conducted the piece had Verdi actually used the Italian national anthem. Verdi had used a Risorgimento hymn called the Hymn of Mameli, which talks about Italia Patria Mia, and Toscanini added the word tradita. Maybe you heard Jan Peer singing Italia Patria Mia Tradita, my betrayed country. This was because of Mussolini, who had just been deposed. And at the end, because it was a piece of Allied war propaganda for World War II, Toscanini tacked on the additional hymns of the remaining allies. Besides England, France, lately Italy, there was the United States at the very end, and the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was represented by what, as of 1943, was still its national anthem, the Internationale. But isn't that an anomaly? A country whose national anthem is the International. They noticed that in the USSR during the war, and as you know, they changed the national anthem. And in fact, they changed the national anthem between the time Toscanini made this film and when it was released. The Soviet national anthem that some of us still remember was first performed in 1944. It was unveiled on January 1st, 1944, adopted officially March 15th. The NBC people, or the war information people, said to Toscanini, you know, they just changed the national anthem. Let's remake the film, putting this new anthem in. Toscanini said, no, if you change that, I'm not going to agree to it. So they left the Internationale in because Toscanini thought of himself as a socialist. You just saw him. He was not much of a socialist, actually. Thought he was. He had been a socialist in his youth and actually once ran for Italian parliament as a socialist. But that was a long time ago. But this is an interesting anomaly. Of course, the history of many countries is full of anomalies. The history of the country in whose capital we are meeting today is a good example. You know that Hungary for a long time was a kingdom without a king, being ruled by an admiral without a navy. So that was an anomaly to which Hungarians, I think, got used. The USSR was a country where they always celebrated the October Revolution in November. I won't go into the reasons for that. And the country in which the national anthem was the International. Because the International, maybe a little bit of the history would be of interest here. It was first just a poem that was written by one of the Communards in Paris in 1871, just to commemorate the Paris Commune. And his name was Eugène Potier. And he originally meant his poem to be sung to the tune of La Marseillaise, which we heard in this. By the way, at the time Verdi wrote the Hymn of Nations, La Marseillaise was not the French national anthem. In fact, Marseillaise was banned in France at that time because it was the second empire. And Marseillaise was thought of as the revolutionary hymn. So this was Verdi kind of thumbing his nose at the actual French government at the time.
But that was the tune to which the Internacional was originally supposed to be sung. De boule gagne de la terre, de boule forza de la femme, or in English, arise you prisoners of starvation, arise you wretched of the earth. The tune that we heard was written about 15 or 17 years later by a man named Pierre. I don't know how to pronounce his last name because it's spelled D-E-G-E-Y-T-E-R. It was a Dutch name, but it was a Belgian. So do you pronounce the name De Geter, or do you pronounce the name De Geter, or do you pronounce the name De Geter? I don't know, and nobody has been able to ask to tell me. I've heard it pronounced both ways, all three ways. As a matter of fact, American communists always pronounced his name as De Geter because the tune was written to a French text. But I went on Russian Google to see how they spelled it in the Russian alphabet, where there's no ambiguity about the letter G, you know. And I discovered, so the Russians, he's De Geter, or De Geter, and they were the ones who sang this as their national anthem. So I'll go with De Geter, although I don't know, what did they know? They were just transliterating it letter by letter, I think. So this is an unknown. If anybody does really know it, can prove it to me that it should be pronounced one way or another. Anyway, his tune was written just as the national anthem of the local socialist party, not the national anthem, the anthem of the local socialist party in Lille, France. They printed up in a bunch of leaflets, and so it circulated. And then it was adopted by the Second International, which was no longer a working man's association or a labor association, because that was the First International. The Second International was an association of socialist parties, including Lenin's party, the Russian Social Democratic Party, which he led the majority faction called the Bolsheviks. And because it was the Bolshevik when the Bolsheviks succeeded in gaining power at the end of 1917, they made it the anthem of the new Soviet state. And it remained the national anthem of Russia until 1943, of the USSR, in fact. So I want to talk a little bit about the reasons why Marxism was against nationalism and why it was, in fact, such a problem for the Soviets to reconcile the idea of nationality, the idea of Russian nationalism, or even the idea of Soviet nationalism, which was, if you think about it, a contradiction in terms, and how they were able to reconcile those differences and make their new anthem. So in a sense, this talk, the first section anyway, is about the history of the way in which the Internacional gave way to the Gimn Sovietskoga Soyuza, the hymn of the Soviet Union, which took over from it in 1944. The reason why Marxism was against nationalism, I think, should be obvious. Nationalism views society vertically. In nationalism, all members of a society that is united within a state are considered to be a unit. So that means that you identify yourself with other members of your nationality rather than with other members of your class. And the reason why this was so against Marxism should be evident. You don't have to delve very deeply into Marxist theory to see the reason. All you have to do is cite the most convenient Marxist slogan, the one that comes from the end of the Communist Manifesto. In English, it comes out, "Workers of the world, unite." But that isn't actually what it says in the original document. In German, it's "Proletarier aller Länder vereinigt euch." Workers of all countries, unite. In Russian, "Proletarii всех стран соединяйтесь," the official motto of the Russian Republic when it was first founded, and became the official motto of the USSR as it was gradually formed after the revolution. So, "Workers of all countries unite." In other words, it was directed specifically and explicitly against nationalism. Do not owe your allegiance to other members of your national society and other classes. You owe your primary allegiance to members of your own class in other countries. So this was a horizontal as opposed to a vertical alignment of society, and that was a very, very fundamental a difference. There could not be such a thing as Marxist nationalism. And the refrain at the end of the Internationale also recognizes this fact, as originally written by Eugène Pottier, and now I'll sing it to the tune written by Degater. C'est la lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale sera le genre humain, or in English, as my mother actually taught it to me, since I do come from that kind of a family, tis the final conflict, let each stand in his place. The International Party, that's the way you send it if you were a socialist, or the International Soviet, which is how you send it if you were a communist, will be the human race. And in Russian, the way it was actually used as a national anthem in the USSR is by the translation by Arkady Yakovlevich Kotz. So the official text for the USSR, every yes, nash, Rodriuskoy means the human race. So it's on behalf of the human race that you sing this song, not on behalf of any particular country. So again, how could it be that this hymn, which is directed against countries, became the national hymn of a country. And not only that, but a country that was actually an empire. And this is why I included the word imperium in my title for this talk, the imperium and the ghetto. The Soviets claimed that what they had done was liberate all the countries that had formerly been part of what Alexander Herzen, and then quoted by Lenin, called the Prison of Nations, Tyurma Narodov in Russian. That was the Russian Empire under the Tsar, the Prison House of Nations, where many other nationalities, many other languages, just as in the Austrian Empire or the Ottoman Empire, were ruled by a dominant nationality. And so this was a situation on the national scale that replicated what was in every bourgeois society on a more local scale. There was a ruling class that dominated and ruined the lives of all of its subordinates. The Soviet concept, of course, was very much very different from that, and it was reflected directly in the words of the new Soviet hymn. Which was written by a man named Alexander Alexandrov. He was the head of the Red Army Song and Dance Ensemble. And the anthem was actually first performed by that organization, conducted by Alexandrov. I guess we could have the second example now. The hymn of the Soviet Union. Until they induced the man who originally wrote the words on about two allies, whose name was Sergei Mikhalkov, the father of the man who now makes movies, Nikita Mikhalkov. He lived to the age of 98, I believe, and he lived to revise his anthem twice, once to de-Stalinize it, and then later to de-Sovietize it completely. So now they have new words to this very same tune, still as the Russian national anthem. You just heard the first stanza, the stanza that everybody knew and everybody could sing up until the end of the Soviet Union. I want to tell you about the other two stanzas, though, because you know the reason why they had to adopt a new anthem is because they were at war. This was the war that the Soviet army and the Soviet government obviously did support, the way the Soviet government did not support World War I. Russia had to leave World War I because of the revolution. You can't be a country at war and have an international as your national anthem. The last verse of the three in the new text actually talks about the war. Mi armi yunashu raspili sraženjach zvachvači dopornih starogi smitjom mi v bitvah rešajem sudbu pokoljeni Slavia, a Jesus, Mayu, Pontidon, which means we raised our army in battles, we will sweep the base invaders from our path, the fascist invaders, so you see specific reference to current events in the original text of the national anthem. In combat, we are deciding the fate of generations, we will lead our homeland to glory. And the second stanza of the national anthem, well, that verse stopped being sung at the end of the war. The second verse stopped being sung in 1956 after Khrushchev made his famous secret speech, because the second verse went like this: Skvozdrozhi siyabla nam solnce svobody, I Lenin veliki nam put azaril. Нас вырастил Сталин на верность народу, на труд и на подвиг, и нас вдохновил. Through storms the sun of freedom shined unto us, and great Lenin illuminated the path before us. Stalin raised us in devotion to the people, inspiring us to industry and to great deeds. So that had to go in 1956, leaving only the verse that everybody still sang until 1991 in Russia. Союз нерушимый, республик свободных, сплотила навеки великая Русь. And I'll stop there just to translate those two lines, because they are so diametrically opposed to everything the Internationale stood for. A union, an indestructible union of three republics was forged for all time by great Russia. That's imperial language. So there had to be some kind of a theory that made it possible for the Soviets to say, well, it may sound like an empire, but it isn't really. And that's what I want to get into somewhat. The way in which they were able to make this argument is included in the text of the hymn of the Soviet Union in the refrain. There's a refrain that comes between each of the stanzas, which goes, Slava Otechestva Nashe Slavodnaya, which means glory to our free fatherland. Fatherland is already not Marxist, right? And then comes a line which is different in each of the three refrains. You know, refrain by definition is the same words and the same music. It's all the same words except for one word which changes in every one of the refrains. In the third refrain, the next line is Slavi narod, narodov, nadyozhny oplot, which means a trusty bulwark of the glory of the nations or glory of the peoples. In the second stanza is Shastya Narodov Nadyozhny Oplot, which means a firm bulwark or a trusty bulwark of the happiness in the peoples. But the first stanza, the one that remained current, the one that everybody knew, if you want to sing along with me, you're welcome to join. It's Druzhby Narodov Nadyozhny Oplot, which means the trusty bulwark of the friendship of the people. And this idea of Druzhba Narodov was the phrase, it was actually a phrase coined by Stalin himself, which gave the pretext or gave the cover to the idea that this new imperium was not really an imperium, but a union of equal nations entered into voluntarily and cemented by the friendship and mutual support that the Soviet Union provided its members. Now, the fact that it was an imperium is a historical fact, because the first thing the Soviet state had to do, if you remember, you know, when the government was formed, it was only the government of Russia, or as it was called in Soviet language, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, RSFSR, which has remained throughout the history of the USSR. So the difference between the RSFSR and the SSSR, the USSR, is that gradually the Soviet government reconstituted the old Russian Empire by reconquering the surrounding territories through wars of aggression. And then after World War II, expanding the territory even further with a whole series of buffer states, of which Hungary, of course, was one. All the nations that had been liberated by the Red Army remained occupied by the Red Army. And so Soviet hegemony went as far as that went. The Soviets felt they needed this so as to preserve the revolution at a time when they were being attacked both by the remnants of the Tsar's army, that was the Whites, in the Civil War, and by a great deal of foreign intervention from England particularly, and also from Americans, and the Czechs as well, that was fighting to undo the revolution. And so that was the rationale for the wars of aggression, which were successful in some areas, such as the Caucasus and in Ukraine, of course. Ukraine went back and forth quite a lot of times between 1917 and 1921. But finally, Soviet power was established there. Soviet power was not reestablished in Poland, and Soviet power was not reestablished in the Baltic states, and it was not reestablished in Finland. That job had to await the assistance from Adolf Hitler. The Soviets were able to reconstitute the western Ukrainian territory, some of them, and didn't get as far as Warsaw, but they wanted to get Poland back, and Hitler helped. Parts of western Belorussia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and of course, you know, they also tried to get Finland back in 1939, when the war of aggression called the Winter War. There, Hitler couldn't give them direct help, because that part of Finland was not actually occupied by the Germans in 1939, but simply an ally of the Germans. But there was an attempt, as you see, to reconstitute the Russian Empire, and yet it was called something else. To understand this something else, I want to cite an article that appeared in Pravda on December 21st, 1939. Those of you with memories will know what day that was. That was the anniversary, that was Stalin's 60th birthday, and the newspapers were carrying nothing except panegyrics to Stalin that day. And the one that I want to recall now was signed by somebody who everybody here knows his name. He wasn't very famous yet in 1939. His name was Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev, who wrote an article that was published on the front page of Pravda on December 21st, 1939. Called Stalin I Velika Druzhba Narodov, Stalin and the Great Friendship of Peoples. There were two catchphrases in that title, Druzhba Narodov, which is in the national anthem, and what I want to show you is how the whole text of that national anthem is foreshadowed in this article by Khrushchev, showing that that text was consciously written in the spirit of this slogan, in the spirit of this way of So, Khrushchev uses all of these words that we've already encountered in the national anthem. The Bolshevik Party correctly approached the solution to the national question in Russia, quoting from Khrushchev, 1939. He was chosen, by the way, because he had just been made party chairman in Ukraine. So he was the representative of one of the nationalities. Nationality in Soviet lingo means anything but Russian. And so he was the largest nationality. He was the head of the party there. So he was appointed from that position to write about nationalities. Under the leadership of Comrade Stalin, the Bolshevik Party welded together all the nationalities, all the people of the former Russia, and on the basis of mutual trust, on the basis of the great friendship of peoples, created the Soviet state, the great union of Soviet socialist republics. The whole first stanza of the national anthem is included there. Not only that it was welded together, that word is blatit in Russian, which you find in the national anthem, but also that what the result of that welding is a Nirushimaya Druzhba, indestructible friendship. And the first line of the new national anthem was Soyuz Nirushimi Respublik Svobodni. Indestructible was always the adjective given to the Druzhba, you see? That's how propaganda works, of course, through catchphrases, through phrases that are repeated again and again and again and again. And finally, ensconced in the national anthem, so you sing it every day. It becomes second nature. The peroration of this article goes like this. In order to defend the independent existence of our state, the passive acknowledgement of the imperialism of the Soviet Union, that is the reason why they had to reconquer the old territories, was to defend the continued existence of Russia as a communist state. In order to defend the independent existence of our state, the solidarity of our people is necessary. We have this solidarity. All the peoples of the great Soviet Union are welded into unity. Again, welded. This is the technique of repetition again. And the word that I'm translating as solidarity is another instance of that repetition. Remember the verb? What did Russia do? It welded the union. Splatit. All the members of the union are welded into unity. Splatjeni. That means past participle, welded. And the word that I'm translating as solidarity is splotchonost. It's a rather unusual word in Russian. Literally, it means weldedness. So what we have is weldedness, because Russia has splotila us into Soyuz. The reason why it became possible to have the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics be actually a Russian-dominated empire and rationalize the dominance of Russia. To rationalize this, I'll quote from a speech by Stalin, also on a famous date, a speech that Stalin gave on December 5th, 1936. Anybody who lived in the Soviet Union or in a state that was ruled by the Soviet Union might remember December 5th as a national holiday. That was called Constitution Day. The date in 1936 when the Constitution of the USSR, which was thereafter always referred to as the Stalinskaya Konstitucia, the Stalin Constitution, was announced by Stalin. And the speech contained this paragraph. The period just passed, which means from the revolution to 1936, which is not very long, you know, 19 years, has shown beyond doubt that the experiment of forming a multinational state created on the basis of socialism has succeeded in full. The character of the peoples of the USSR has fundamentally changed. That was the also the contention of Marxism. If you change material conditions, you change environment, you also change nature, including human nature. So the character of the peoples of the USSR has fundamentally changed. The feeling among them of mutual distrust has disappeared. That was the difference between the Union and the old empire. Because in the old empire, the outlying nationalities distrusted the Russians, but here everybody trusts the Russians. Stalin could say this because he wasn't Russian, right? He was Georgian, but he was the biggest Russian chauvinist of them all. How do you reconcile that apparent paradox? Well, he wasn't pro-Russian, he was pro-centralization. centralize the union so that all the orders came from the center to the periphery, from the top down, was to make Russia dominant. So he was always propounding Russian dominance. The feeling among the members of this trust has disappeared. The feeling of mutual friendship has developed. And in this way, genuine fraternal cooperation of the peoples had been established within the system of a single unified state. As a result, we now have a fully formed multinational socialist state, which has withstood all the trials, and whose solidity might well be envied by any national state in any part of the world. So we have achieved solidarity, we have achieved mutual trust, we have achieved the friendship of peoples. So now we no longer have to institute the policy that brought about this change. That was the policy known as indigenization or Karenizatsiya in Russian, which was developing the native cultures, having the outlying countries have all of their educational, primary education in the native languages, a press in the native language, even a written language for the first time in some cases, and to have the figurehead of all the governments be natives speaking the native language. All of this now could change because we have achieved mutual trust and now Russia can assert its leadership. As the Ravni Mostarshi brat, as the equal but elder brother. So first among equals. There's one other phrase that I want to explain very briefly. I see the time is flying. And that is how this was applied to culture. It was through another slogan that was repeated endlessly. Soviet culture, and here's where music will be has to be the Druzhba Narodov, Soviet culture has to be national in form, socialist in content. You know this phrase. It's the most, it's the vaguest phrase. Nobody knew what the hell Stalin first said it. And for that reason, there was a huge literature of exegesis explaining the phrase. But it's not that hard to understand if you just think of the simplest examples of social, of national informed socialism content. And that was all of the fake Soviet folklore that grew up, and sometimes it's called fake lore, sung by people either in habitat or sometimes in Moscow. They would have dekadas, they called them, 10-day periods or weeks devoted to the art of the various Union republics, and they would come in their native costumes and sing in their native language songs glorifying Lenin and Stalin. So you see, in the costume and in the language, those were aspects of the exterior form, right? All of that was native. The content, the actual words, were all about Lenin and Stalin. But the pretense was, of course, always that this was genuine folklore, that it was national in form, socialist. One of these songs, a very, very famous one. The Russians did this too, got up in their peasant costumes and using the diction of folk poetry, sing about Lenin and Stalin. And one of these famous songs is called Glasovala, two falcons sitting on a branch looking out over the wide expanse that is looking into the future. The two wise falcons who are tied in the USSR, Pierre Sokol and Lenin. The first falcon is Lenin. Второй Sokol. So this is an example of art that is national in form, socialist in content. After de-Stalinization, of course, the words actually changed. They changed to Первый Сокол Ленин, Второй Сокол Онже, which means first Сокол, the first Falcon Ленин, second Falcon also Ленин. Why do you need two Falcons if they're both Ленин? Well, you have to know the history of the song. So socialist in form, national in form, socialist in content. Harder to apply that to artistic music, and especially hard to apply to instrumental music. But that's why we need all that exegesis. All right, so from here on, let me just show you some examples of this art, which is national informed socialism content. Among the things that were displayed at the Dekadi showcases of national culture were operas. Operas that were written to inaugurate national opera theaters in various countries. And for this purpose, Russian composers would be sent around to all the national capitals, especially the five stands, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkmenistan, did I say that one already? Kazakhstan? Yeah, that was the biggest one, I shouldn't forget it. They all had their operas their national operatic tradition started in the 1930s, by Russian composers who were sent out to sometimes collaborate with native ones. That was one of those ways in which the Druzhba Narod was expressed, by having a starshy brat, you know, an elder brother from Russia and a younger brother from the Republic. So there were national operas in all the languages of these countries. The first of them was the Kazakh one, written by a composer named Brusilovsky, who is still honored in Kazakhstan today as the great national musical figure, even though obviously I haven't got a Kazakh name. We have the next, yes, that's a stamp issued by post-Soviet Kazakhstan, and that's Yevgeny Brusilovsky, the great national composer, who was sent out to found their national opera. Now, the next example is from something I found on YouTube. You know, YouTube is absolutely amazing. There's nothing you can't find on YouTube. I typed Brusilovsky into YouTube, and I got 24 hits. And one of them was a TV documentary that was made for Russian consumption by the Kazakh Republic, post-Soviet Kazakh Republic, all about Brusilovsky founding Kazakh music. Just listen to the opening narration.
Когда ему говорили, что он красиво интерпретирует казахский мелос, он отвечал: «Эту музыку я беру взаймы у народа». Подобно добытчику руды, он разрабатывал нетронутые пласты, извлекая из них истинное сокровище. Примером своим он показывал, как надо подходить к толкованию народной музыки, как облекать ее в классическую форму. Приход его в наше национальное искусство – это явление. Я говорю так вполне уверенно, потому что имела счастье убедиться в этом сама на конкретных постановках. Гульфайрус Исмаилова, народный худ.
Thank you.
forgive me for what I'm about to play. the theme from Exodus. Including one very famous composer from one of the republics, from one of the Nazi anonymous, and that was Aaron Khachaturian, whose picture is on our program. And it might be, because Khachaturian was the only composer who was actually from one of those nationalities, although he never lived in Armenia. He was still called the Armenian composer, who achieved world fame. And that was the reason for his being denounced in 1948. But the party had a problem because the whole idea of him being a formalist, which was the charge that was leveled against the big four of Soviet music, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Minkowski, Khachaturian, the charge seemed so implausible in the case of Khachaturian. I mean, you know, Prokofiev was for two decades an emigre, so yes, of course he's a formalist. Shostakovich had already been censured for Lady Macbeth. So he's the usual suspect, right? So yeah, he's a formalist. Yuskovsky wrote 27 symphonies. I mean, if that isn't formalism, what is, right? How is the author of Saber Dance a formalist? Well, this is how. The party commission from Tamara Ivanova, who was a musicologist and a big enforcer, she was the most partine of all musicologists of that period, an article for Sovietska Muzika, which was the organ of the say, why is Khachaturian a formalist? The reason is that in his early works, his big works that made him famous, Piano Concerto, Violin Concerto, these are works you probably know, these are still his most famous works except for Saber Dance. He was writing as an Armenian, and it sounded Armenian, according to what it sounded like to Dusilovsky. And that was his peak. And those were his earliest two works. And you know what follows a peak, right? After a peak, there can only be one way to go, right? That's down. How did he go down? His latest work, the one that he wrote in 1947 to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the October Revolution, Sinfonia Poema, which was a huge work that had, in addition to a very large orchestra, an organ, and concertina. I want to take the organ out of the church and bring it into the light of Soviet day, you know, something like that. It sounded great. Why is that formalism? And 15 trumpets to play fanfare. So, you know, he expected big success. But Ivanova writes, but where's the Armenian sound in this music? Instead, he's trying to sound generally human, universal, in other words. You mustn't sound universal, you have to sound Armenian. And that's why the word ghetto is in my title. In order to fit into the imperium, anybody who wasn't Russian had to live in a ghetto. And of course, ghettos were set up originally for Jews, and it was always the strangest applications of Soviet nationality party policies were the application to Jews, because according to most theories of nationalism, the Jews are an ambiguous nation. Because most theories of nationalism, including Stalin's, because before the revolution, Stalin was the expert on nationalities. He wrote a treatise on nationalities adapted from previous Marxist works in 1913. And so what's a nation? A nation is shared language, shared territory, shared psychological makeup, whatever that is, shared economic structure, shared history. The Jews don't have a shared vernacular language. The Jews don't have a territory. In the Soviet Union, it became a nationality, but always an ambiguous one. So the application of the theory always became very fraught with Jews. Such was the case with the leading Jewish composer of the 1940s and into the later period. That was Mieczysław Weinberg, who in the Soviet Union was known as Maisei Weinberg, because, you know, better to be a Jew than a Pole in the USSR. So that was better for him that way. But the name was given to him by a border guard when he escaped from Poland. He escaped the Nazis into the Soviet, you know, out of the frying pan, you might say, I don't know. But at the border, he was asked his name, and she thought, what the hell is that? You're Jewish, aren't you? Yes, all right, your name is Maisei. And that's what it became for the next 40 years. Interestingly enough, in 1948, when Khachaturian was being denounced, Weinberg was being promoted precisely because his music could be used to show the happy fate of the Jews in the land of the Soviets in contrast to the fate of the Jews and the fascists. So a work of his that was written in, right after the revolution, where he adopted a very obviously Jewish sounding style, again, as you'll see, adopted out of the old Russian traditions of exoticism, was praised by Tikhon Khrennikov. Same time that Khachaturian was being denounced. Let's have that one last example. This is the second movement of the Sinfonietta by Weinberg. Because both of them are Russian, because Balakirev set that standard as an exotic Russian style. For this he was praised. You might say that doesn't sound very Soviet and optimistic, but that's the slogan of that four. The first movement is Bodrei Rashishina. It's high-spirited and decisive. That's how Jews are in the land of the Soviets. The last movement is Ochin Bystrei Radostno, very fast and joyous. This is Medlina Piruche, which means something like Andante Cantabile. So the same style, transferred in 1948 and 49, when many other composers were being censured. It came Weinberg's turn in 1953. He was arrested because he was unfortunate enough, although he probably thought himself a killer, very fortunate, to have married into one of the most prominent Russian or Soviet Jewish families. His father-in-law was Solomon Michaels, who was the head of the Jewish State Theater, and he had been executed in 1948. And he was also the nephew by marriage of Miron Vopsi, who was the head doctor who was arrested in 1953 as part of the doctor's plot. That is, Stalin thought that the Kremlin doctors were trying to poison him and the other members of the Politburo. Bureau, so all the doctors, the Kremlin, of which almost all were Jews, were arrested, and their families also, many people were arrested. When the charges were read against Weinberg, he was charged with bourgeois nationalism. And this piece, Sinfonietta, for which he'd been praised in 1948, was cited as evidence against him in 53, which illustrates what I demonstrated with that joke from Peanuts, you know. You are encouraged to be national up to a point, but where that point is, you don't know. And in all likelihood, you've already passed that point, but you'll only be told about it when it's the time, and then it's too late. So forgive me for telling jokes about matters of such gravity and such seriousness, but you know, probably it's an old Jewish tradition, you always have to tell jokes, otherwise you'd cry. Thank you very much.